So this week, we're on week number 4 in this series, Made for This. And we're made to cultivate an environment of growth in all the areas of our life. That's what we're made to do. So God designed us very intentionally to do that, whether it's in our heart. We should be cultivating an environment of growth in our heart, in our homes. And how have we done this with that this week? Been working at that? We talked about it a bit last week, so I'm hoping that you're working on that. And then in our church, we'll talk about today, and next week in our community. And so to start this off, I have a question for you. What's the most valuable thing you have on you right now? The most valuable thing you have on you right now? Okay, Jeff, I know. Everybody's like, my Bible. Yeah, I know, super spiritual people here. I know. You should say that. I get it. Okay, outside of, because that's the given, everybody started to hold up their Bible, like the pastor asks, what should, okay, cool. Okay, not necessarily outside the Bible. You can keep that in your mind, but let's go a little further than our Bible, okay? What's the most valuable thing you have on you right now? Okay, how many say wedding band? Okay? Okay, what else? Glasses. For serious. Okay? What else?
Car keys.
Car keys. Good. Your phone? Yeah. Or is that your wallet, your phone?
Yeah, wallet.
Okay. So you have like $5 in there? College kid, you know? It's like, I'm rich, I got $5. Sorry, I'm messing with you. Okay. Cell phone for some of you. Like you had the, it used to be your most valuable, now it's 2 years old and it's like junk, right? It's kind of funny. For me, the most valuable thing, and I brought it up here, I won't put it on in my pocket because it's annoying, but car keys would be my most valuable thing that I would typically have on me. And the most valuable of all of this would be my truck, which it probably shouldn't be. But I have keys for my truck, keys for my wife's Pilot, which is technically more valuable, but not to me. I have keys to the church, which I don't own, but my kids think I do. Keys to my office. I don't know what that one is for or that one, but something. Keys for a couple of cars that my kids own or don't own, but it's in my name, but they drive all the time. And keys to my house. And so these would be the most valuable thing in my life. It's like the keys to get into what I have in my life. And you have certain things that you'd say, these are the most valuable things. And if I lost any one of these things, In the past year, a couple of these cars we lost. One got hit on the street and was an uninsured person that hit it, so it was a total loss. It was just gone, and no insurance helped us out. Another one got hit, and the insurance helped us with that, and that worked out. But it was like, okay, we had to totally rearrange things. I was talking with somebody down in South Carolina, and someone actually arsoned. That's not the right way of saying it, but they burnt the church down. That's the right thing. I was stuck. They literally burnt the church down. It was by arson, which that would be pretty interesting to say, hey, we can't meet here because, it got burnt down yesterday. So there's a lot of valuable things that we have, and what would happen to you if you lost them? Now, I know in the back of your mind, there's a couple other things. You're like, well, my spouse is my most valuable thing. I know. And some of you are like, no, it's not. But we'll work on that. But anyway, what would happen if you lose that most valuable thing in your life? How would that affect you? For many, it would really affect us negatively. It'd be a challenge not only for a day, for the week, for the month, it could be for the year, or some for our lifetime even. And what you've expressed to me this morning already in your attendance here and your engagement so far is that this is valuable to you, right? It is valuable to you, not because the pews are so comfortable, right? It's valuable to you because you want to hear more from God's word. It's valuable to you because you have people that you have around you that you say, I like to be with them, and this is a great place to hang out together and get to know them and go through life together with them. And so you've spent some time here at church, and this is valuable. Maybe this is your first time here, and you're like, well, I don't know if it's valuable yet, but we'll find out in about 45 minutes or so whether it is, and you're still debating that. But by being here, you're saying that something's valuable about this time being here in this building with these people. And I appreciate that. Church did not always exist. Do you realize that? About 2,000 years ago, the church did not exist prior to that. So Jesus introduces it to his followers, his closest friends, and he's talking with them, and he says that he's going to build his church. And when he says that, I couldn't imagine what they were thinking, because it was not something that we would look at in the same way as they would. We would look and say, oh, cool, is it Baptist, Presbyterian, non-denominational, is it Catholic? What kind of church is it? And what kind of windows, stained glass, regular glass? And what kind of building do you have? Is it big? Is it small? The steeple or no steeple? Or, you know, and we'd have all these kinds of questions about it. When you say you're going to build a church, what do you mean by that? Well, the disciples, they didn't have that perspective at all. So for them, when Jesus said, I'm going to build my church, it was literally the called out ones, the ecclesia. And so when he said that, they're just thinking, my imagination, they're just thinking, I don't even know what he just said, but it's something that we're probably part of. Little did they know what would happen in the next few years, really in the next 2 years of their life. How God would build his church through them, but not something that they intentionally did on their own. It was just something they were part of as he was working through them. And I want to talk about that this morning and go back to the very first time that Jesus said this, because this is key to cultivating an environment of growth in our church. Matthew chapter 16, if you have your Bibles there, open them with me to Matthew chapter 16, or you have it on your app, your YouVersion app, or whatever, a Bible app that you have on your phone. Open that out to Matthew chapter 16. We're going to spend our time here. I'm going to reference one other thing, but we'll spend our time here in Matthew chapter 16. So here Jesus mentions this, and when he does, this is an amazing statement that he's making to them that we have context to, but they did not. So Matthew chapter 16, verse 13, and I'm jumping into the middle of this, which really has a greater context that we'll deal with as we go. So Matthew chapter 16, verse 13 says, now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And the Son of Man is referring to himself, as he referred to himself that way in many different times in his ministry there with the people. So who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, and here's his disciples saying, well, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And so he said to them, okay, but who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? So now he's speaking of the Son of Man, and then he's speaking of himself, and he's pulling the two together as we would see it. And as they would see it, they would kind of contextualize it based on how they would interpret those things. But they say back to him, some say it's John the Baptist, some say it's Elijah, others say it's Jeremiah. And these are prophets of the Old Testament, Elijah and Jeremiah. And so people are saying different things where they look and they say, well, this one is this special person that existed before, and it's just a normal, ordinary person. That's who John the Baptist, Elijah, and Jeremiah were. While they were great people, great men of God, they were just ordinary people like you and I that God used in fantastic ways to communicate his truth to people around. But Jesus was different than that, and he turns back to them and he says to them, who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Now, there's a lot of confusion about Jesus today. Would you agree? Yesterday, after the memorial service, I was talking with someone, and I said, hey, what do you think about Jesus? And their response was something like this. They said, well, Jesus was this special person, I guess, and he's really famous, and he did some really cool things, but I don't believe in him like you talk about him. I believe in, and they begin to elaborate their beliefs in something other than Jesus, and that Jesus was just an ordinary man that became popular in his day, and his teachings became popular throughout history. And I would look at that and say, I respect and understand what you're saying. However, I see it a little bit differently. And here's the way Peter says it, If you've been coming here and you say, okay, I agree with things here, here's how we would say it, just like Peter does. Peter says, you are the Christ, which is the Messiah, the anointed one. You are that special one that's been talked about from Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, all the way through. You're the one we've been waiting for. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now that's incredible. He is making Jesus equal with God. He's saying, you are all human and you are all God. Paul would reflect on that later on in Philippians chapter 2, but he's making that very dogmatic statement, and it's a huge statement. Why in the world would anybody say that Jesus is fully God? If Jesus was God, think about this. When he's hanging up on the cross and you have got the two thieves on either side, about 6 or 8 feet away from him, they would say, hey, where's God in this? And Jesus would say, I'm right here. Right? If Jesus is really God, he would need to prove it. Because you can't just come to the earth and say, I'm God, and get away with that. Would you agree? You can be a superhero for Marvel or whatever, but you can't come and say, I am God, and just get away with that statement. So Jesus didn't just leave it there. Jesus went a step further. Jesus actually identified himself as God by doing many different things that would articulate and clarify to us for all generations that he truly is God. Here's what he did, and let me just kind of walk through a few. He turned water to wine. How many of you have turned water to wine? Wouldn't that be amazing? Now, maybe you're really conservative. You're like, I don't believe in wine. Okay, turn to grape juice. Just try that. Wine's way better. Because what he's saying, in order to turn water to wine, do you realize what he would have to do? It's not a, oops, slip something in the water and now it tastes like wine. No. He would actually have to control the elements and control time, because in order to have fine wine, which is what was tasted then, you would actually have to control time. Because it's a process in order for it to become something that is really tasty. That's what I hear anyway. Whatever. Right? But he would have to control the elements then and change everything. Well, only God could do that, wouldn't you agree? But a really cool magician might figure out a way to make it happen. Okay. Here's another one. He's in the boat with his disciples, and a storm comes up, and he's taking a nap. And while he's sleeping, the disciples are going nuts, and they're like fishermen. That's what they do. And they come screaming at Jesus, don't you care that we're about to die? Right? Okay, it's dramatic for your sake. Okay. And what does he say? Oh, yeah. Peace, be still. And the wind stops, and the water stops, and here they are just sitting in a peaceful sea. And now they're terrified. Could you imagine? Wouldn't you be terrified? I mean, they're just, can you help us bail out? He didn't care about bailing out the boat. He's probably annoyed that they woke him up from a nap. You've been there where your kids are like, Mom, they're touching me. You know? There are several times, actually, that you find that Jesus is a little bit annoyed with the disciples for the things that they request. And then you find there are several times that Jesus does some miraculous things that the response by the disciples is they were astonished. They marveled. They were like in anxiety mode, like, what just happened? So here's another one. They're out fishing, and they're not catching anything, and Jesus says, hey, why don't you throw the nets on the other side? Okay, fishermen, does that work? You're fishing on one side of the boat, and somebody says, look, don't cast it out the other way, because that's a different story. Take your nets, which are 4 feet over here, and move them 4 feet over here, and then you're going to catch something. And what do? Okay. Drop it in. That was weird. Did you stay? Whoa, what's going on here? And all of a sudden, the fish are gathering at the net. So much so that the boat was about to sink. So God would have to be in control of the wind, the water, the fish. Fish listen to him. There was another time where he cursed or killed off by spoken word, just a plant. That's another story. How about the times that he had thousands of people? So at one point it was 4,000, another time it was 5,000. They said, you know, some estimate that it was more than that because it just says there's men, there's women, children, who knows. But it was thousands of people gathered together. And they're like, man, they're hungry. What do we do? Like McDonald's and Burger King, it's not going to happen. So what do we do? And he says, well, let's just have them sit down. We'll feed them. With what? I mean, all we got is this little kid that mom was diligent with this little kid because, you know, he needs to eat, and we got his lunch, and that's it. What are you going to do with that? He just says, I got it. Could you imagine being there, handing that out? And it was so much so that the thousands of people that were fed, the next day they're like, hey, we're following Jesus because we just want food. We don't have to do grocery shopping this week. We're following Jesus. I don't know what he's feeding us, but this is going to be good. And it was 4,000 and 5,000. How about the times that he healed the sick? It was a known fact that he was healing the sick. It was such a problem to some. They were frustrated with him healing the sick because it's on the Sabbath day and such like that. But he healed people. I jotted this down, the people that he healed. People that were paralyzed. People with leprosy. Listen, these are things that you don't just get over. People with fever. Blindness, deaf, mute, and several other things. So he healed all kinds of people with all kinds of diseases. See, so what he's saying is, I'm more powerful than the sickness that kills people off. I could walk into a hospital, and by one spoken word, I can heal the thousands of people that are in this hospital right now. I could walk into the emergency room, and as people come in, I could say, you're healed, and they'd walk back out. Okay, and that'd be it. Could you imagine this? Wouldn't you go to him if you felt a little bit like a headache was coming on? He cast out demons. So he's identifying these more powerful than demons, even. What he's doing with all of these things is the same thing. He's saying, I am God. And in order to be God, you've got to be able to be more powerful than the weather. You've got to be more powerful than the elements, more powerful than the animals, more powerful than the trees and the bushes and all the things around. You've got to be more powerful than the demonic presence. You've got to be more powerful than any sickness. You've got to be more powerful than the thing that no one can escape. Death. You've got to be more powerful. If you're God that says you've existed eternally, you must be more powerful than death. And so the first one is the widow's son in Luke 7. Jesus raises from the dead. The second one is the ruler's daughter in Matthew chapter 9. Jesus raises from the dead. And then the third one is Lazarus, his friend, he raises from the dead, which got him into big trouble then. And the last was that he would raise himself from the dead. Isn't that awesome? He's more powerful than anything around us. What gives you anxiety? Does it give you anxiety when somebody talks bad about you? Does it give you anxiety when your food's late? Does it give you anxiety when you're late for an appointment? Does it give you anxiety when you're waiting for the doctor to say you have? There's all kinds of things that might give us anxiety, but when you look at the reality of where Jesus is, he's identifying that he is greater than all of the things that could possibly give us anxiety. Do you see it? And so he says in verse 17, as Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, he says back to him, and Jesus answered, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. This is significant, this is special, what you've just said. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock, which is a play of words here in the Greek, where he's saying that his name again, on this rock, Petros, he says, I will build my church. Now, it's not referring to Peter being what he builds the church on. He's referring to it as the faith statement of what he just said, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And by saying that, by making that statement, what he's saying back to them is, I'm going to build my church on this. Not on you, Peter, but on this faith statement. That you understand that Jesus is the Messiah, the one that's talked about in all of the Old Testament. And when you come to this point, you realize that here's why he came, to give his life as a ransom for all of us. He says, I'm going to build my church on this one thing. When we look at having a healthy or growing church, a healthy or growing church, create an environment, a culture, or to cultivate an environment where our church is growing, it comes back to this one statement. There is no other statement than this. A growing church must identify with this one statement, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, who's more powerful than the wind, who's more powerful than the storm in your life, more powerful than the storm on this earth, more powerful than sickness, more powerful than death, more powerful than anything else in this life, that Jesus Christ is the Son of the living God. Now, if we were in any other church that was more animated, you'd be like, yeah! So I did it for you. All right, good. It's as good as it gets. So in contrast, then the church, to cultivate an environment of growth in the church, cannot be about a personality, a building, a program, or past history? To cultivate an environment of growth has to be and can only and always be on the Son of the living God, on Jesus Christ. He is the Messiah. He's the one more powerful than anything. And truthfully, this is what sets Christianity apart from every religion. Some say, how can you narrow down and only be one religion? Like, they all kind of lead to heaven, probably. And how can you study them all? They're easy to study. They all have the same basic premise. If you do this, then God will respond by being kind of okay with you. You might get into the presence of God. And here's what Christianity says. You can't do anything. He did it all. He's the Messiah. He's the Son of the living God. He's taken care of it. And he's more powerful than you. You're not God. You can't manipulate God. And so therefore, when we come together, we come humbly saying, man, because of what he's done, that's why I do this. That's why I'm here. That's why we value this. So he says, on this rock, I will build my church. Now, what's fascinating, when you read this down through, and we're going to come back to this, he says in verse 19, I won't come back to this because this is a message in and of itself. He says, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. So don't publicize this because they're going to get the wrong idea. Okay? There are several times leading up to his death that Jesus says, don't tell. He heals a blind man. Don't tell anybody. He heals the lame. Don't tell anybody. He makes this statement. Don't tell anybody. Just keep it to yourself. Now, after his death, burial, and resurrection, he says, go tell everybody. Different story, different time. Now, in verse 21, see the next part because this is so huge. It says, from that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. So here's the first time that he's articulating to them that here's what's about to happen. In the near future, I'm going to be going to Jerusalem, and I'm going to be delivered over and be put to death. And when you look at this person that can do all this, he can heal, he can raise the dead, he can calm the wind, he can do all of these things. What would you say back to the statement? Wouldn't you agree with what Peter's about to say here? Where he goes and he says, verse 22, and Peter took him aside. Like he has this, like, putting his arm around him. Hey, Jesus, buddy, listen. We got this, like, bromance going on here. I need to talk to you about that thing you said. We're going to Jerusalem, and you know how you're going to, Jesus, let me just help you out, man. I got your back. It's not going to happen. On my watch, that will never happen. He rebuked him, is what the text says. How many of you have rebuked Jesus? Is that a good place or bad place to be? Well, he says, far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you. Verse 23, Jesus' response. This is awesome. He turned and said to Peter, as he's pushing his arm off of his shoulder, saying this a little bit louder for everybody here. That's the context that I see. Get thee behind me, Satan. Like, it's one thing to say, you're just like your mom. Right? But let's clarify this. What Jesus just say to Peter, his buddy? He's got his arm around him. Look, I got your back. And what does he say back to him? Get thee behind me what? Don't you find this a little bit curious? If you were there getting rebuked by Jesus, what would you do? You'd need depends next time you're around Jesus, right? Like, this would be, what? But I got your back. You just call me Satan? For real? I think I would back up. But Jesus clarifies. He doesn't stop there, and this is the point. He says, you are a hindrance to me. What? I got your back. For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. You see, Peter, here's where you are. You're looking at life totally opposite of me. Matter of fact, you're looking at it through the lens of Satan. Not my lens. So Peter and all of the other disciples have this desire, just like you and I do, to hold on to the things that we value. Where Peter, very simply, very honestly, just like you and I, values the relationship and the experiences that he's having with Jesus. And the expectation with Jesus is that as he walks through this next phase, it's that he's going to set up a kingdom, take over the Roman Empire, and all of a sudden Jesus is going to be king. And he's hoping, as you find out later, that he's going to be right or left or right there with Jesus. That's the expectations of all of them, Judas included. And I would even argue that the reason Judas betrayed Jesus was to get things moving along. That's another story. But think about this. Jesus responds back to Peter and says, your mind is not on the things of God. They're on the things that are opposite of God because of what you're holding on to. So he goes from saying, Peter, on this rock, I'll build my church, to Peter, you're a hindrance. You devil? Whoo! Talk about a rough conversation. So then go down to verse 24, because Jesus isn't done. Then Jesus told his disciples. So maybe he's talking with him right there, as you know, and they kind of hear, and he leans over and talks to all of his disciples, and he says this. If anyone would come after me, and they've all done this, they've all dropped their nets, they've all said, I'll follow you regardless of what my wife says, regardless of what my girlfriend says, regardless of what this does to my future, regardless of my college that I'm in, regardless of everything that in my life, I'm dropping everything and I'm following you regardless of the cost. They've already done that. And now he says to them, he continues on, he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny what? Himself. I thought we already did that. But then he says something that's totally messed up here. He says, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Now, we have the context looking back, understanding what the cross means. They did not. So when he's saying take up the cross, they're looking and saying, what? What are you talking about? Jesus didn't give his life. Here's what the Roman cross was at that time. And by the way, the Romans didn't come up with this. They came up, they borrowed this from somebody else, and they kind of perfected it for their culture to be this hideous kind of way of killing someone. And here's the way, and recent things I'm studying and such, here's the way that the cross really was. It was a place where you would crucify someone. You'd either tie them up onto this beam, or often, most of the time, you'd nail them to this beam. And we often see in cinema or in movies and things that the cross was way up here and you'd be looking up. And from what I'm reading and understanding, it actually wasn't. They would be like just inches, their feet would be inches off of the ground. And the reason for that is because if they were the thief that stole from you and hurt you and did all kinds of things, well, how do you feel when you're a victim? Don't you want to get back at them? And if you're the victim of the person that's on the cross, what you'll do is you get to go up to that person and you get to spit in their face and you get to slap them if you want to. You get to yell at them and they are defenseless against you because they are like this. It's the one time that the Pharisees and Sadducees, and they were excited because Jesus, he was done. He is defenseless and they could say whatever they want. They could spit on his face. They could mock him. And the others did as well. So when he says to them, take up your cross, they're looking and they're like, what? No, hold on. What are you talking about? Our plan, the idea we have in our mind is that we're going to gain respect and value and validation from everyone because we're going to be next in line for the throne, or we're going to be around the throne, and we're going to be there in Jesus' kingdom, and everyone will see us. So we will be validated for the things we're going through. We will be respected because of the position we're in. We'll have all of that. And he's saying, no, it's not about that. It's the total opposite. What really is going to occur is if you're truly a follower of me, you're going to take up your cross and follow me. In order to do that, you have to deny yourself. So the only way you and I would ever do anything like that, the only way I would buy the house that I bought and go into the debt I went to, spend 30 years of my life paying for it, because I consider that valuable to me. I spent years, saving for and wanting to get, and because I found it valuable to me. And if you took any one of these things that are represented on this key ring away, and let's go further. If you took the things that are represented by this ring away, it would hurt. It'd be painful. Because I consider all of those things and those people in my life very valuable. Right? You do too. You get it. The only way I would give up anything in this life is if I considered that to be, or them to be, more valuable than this. And the only way that I would truly come and understand what Jesus is saying here, where he says, come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. The only way that I would ever do anything like that is if I looked at this key ring, and I looked at this ring, and I looked at the things that I consider to be valuable, and I said, but Jesus is more valuable than this. That's huge. Jesus is more valuable than my health. He is more valuable than the value that I want other people to place into me. He has more value than the things that I own. He has more value than everything. And what that leads me into is worship, not music worship. Like we often equate music and worship and say, we're going to worship now. No, that's just singing music. That doesn't mean you're worshiping. That just means you're singing, right? But true worship is to say you are worth way more than everything else. The value that I place on you is above this. The value I place on you is above this. The value I place on you is above everything. And I would suggest to you that the problem that we have in the church and our culture, by and large, is a worship issue. For the past 20 years, in pastor conferences and books that I've read, we've heard about worship wars, and it's always talking about music. And what I would actually say is that the worship is much deeper than the music. The worship is that it's a worship of self, in that I want my style, I want my things, I want it to be all about me. That's the true war. That's a whole nother story. So here, we're to cultivate an environment of growth in our church through worship. By denying ourselves, by taking up a cross and following Him. It's worship. It's, you're greater. Wherever you lead me is where I'm going to go. Is that easy? No. No, if you find it easy, that's awesome. Talk to me afterwards. Luke chapter 18, verse 9 through 14, identifies what humility looks like. And I just want to read this through. It's a quick story. It's Luke chapter 18. In verse 9, so Luke chapter 18, verse 9, and Jesus is talking, and it says, He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. And so they looked and they said, there's no reason to really worship God because I'm valuable in and of myself because I've got it together. It says, and here's what Jesus says, here's his parable. Two men went up into the temple to pray, so the house of God they went into to pray. So they're doing the right thing. It's supposed to be a house of prayer. So they both have the same actions. He says, one, a Pharisee, and the other, a tax collector. When you see those two words together, the Pharisee is this religious nut that everyone says, man, they're respectable. If their kid wants to marry my kid, yeah, absolutely, because they've got it together, okay? And the other is a tax collector. They're the ones that were hated. You could, by law, you could lie to a tax collector, is what I've read, because they were hated. Nobody liked a tax collector. And, so he says, verse 11, the Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. Like, see the list he's putting himself into? He's saying, I'm not like this. I'm not an adulterer. I'm not a thief. I'm not like this. I'm not unjust. I'm not, I don't believe in extortion. I'm not like this. Here's what I am like in the next verse. I fast twice a week. Like, I go without food even. I'm really into this thing. I give tithes of all that I get, a tenth. So when the offering plate comes around, I'm giving for sure. Like, I've got this together. But the tax collector, standing afar off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven. He felt embarrassed to even talk to God. He looked at God with such worth and saying, I can't even come into his presence hardly. I'm not looking up. I'm embarrassed for who I am. The humility that he's going through, the shame of where he's at. He beat his breast, and I could kind of hear him aching in his voice or maybe in tears as he's saying this. He said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. That's all he said. He didn't spout out, I'm valuable because of what I do. He said, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Jesus responds and says, I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted in his time, not ours. You see, that's the whole point. It's worship comes from humility. It's acknowledging that he is greater. It's simply coming to God constantly and every day and moment by moment saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Like, I don't even deserve to look up at you. That's the reality. So when people from the outside come into this church, they're not looking at people that are judgmental, critical, irritated with them and annoyed because they sat in my pew. No, we're looking and we're saying, we're so glad that you're here, and I can hardly look up at God because I have this huge value in him. And God decided that I didn't need my car this week, and that's okay because I have value in him. And God decided that this sickness was part of my life, and that's okay because I have value in him. And it's not from this trite kind of plastic sense of spirituality, but it's from an authentic heart that truly values God. Do you see the distinction? Do you know why the next generation doesn't like the church? The top reason is right there. Because the church looks much more like the Pharisee as, look what I did, look what I did, look what I did. And they're looking and saying, I just want somebody that can be authentic because my life's a wreck and I can't figure that out. And I'd like to go to a place where it's just authentic and real. And it's not just the next generation. It's the last too, isn't it? We get tired of plastic, don't we? We want the real deal. And that's why we are where we are. I continue just to stay right here. Like, we want to be real, authentic. But just like Peter and the other disciples, the Pharisees and everyone else, I believe our deepest struggle is with worship, very simply. I think our deepest struggle really comes down to who we worship, when we worship, how we worship. The truth is, about me and you, maybe you're better than me, and that's cool if you are. It's awesome. Maybe you've got a handle on this. Here's the reality of my heart, and I know it. This is something I constantly have to work at. I would rather people worship me. You ever been there? I want people to validate my existence. I want people to put value on me. The biggest temptation in going into ministry is right there. And what I've understood by most pastors, that if they're successful and they have these big churches, the hardest thing they go through is staying away from that worship of self. Because it's so easy. It destroys many. And that could be in any field, couldn't it? It could be as a salesman. I want people to validate me through sales. I want people to validate me by saying thank you for cleaning the house. I want people to validate me by saying you're just a great person. I want people to validate me by likes on Facebook. I want people to validate me through this, that, and the other thing. And we're constantly looking for validation, which is really, if we're going to be honest about it, it's really we want people to worship us and say we are so great. And really, the other perspective should be that rather than being so busy looking for validation, we should be so busy worshiping the Creator and just giving Him praise for what He allowed us to do. And there's a big difference between validation and encouragement. Encouragement is necessary. Encouragement is commanded. Encouragement is scriptural. Flattery is sinful. Okay? That's lying and stuff. Okay, but encouragement is something that should happen regularly. But when you in your heart, you know your heart, when you're doing things in order to be validated and worshiped and people to give you worth in your life, then you've missed the point of worship. The church that God wants us to cultivate and grow has nothing to do with the size of it. Has everything to do with our heart with Him. That our heart is all about worshiping Him. That He is chief. He is everything. He is only. I discovered something on Friday as I drove up. I flew out of Trenton Airport. That airport is tiny. Have you been there? I loved it. I drove up, parked my car. There wasn't crazy traffic. As a matter of fact, it was a really nice drive. I got there. I parked my car, walked into the place, the hangar, and I guess, I don't know what it is. But you, terminal, that's it. Yeah, thanks. Man, I'm struggling. And so I go in the terminal, and there's two planes. Ours had not yet arrived, and so we're, everybody's sitting there watching and waiting for our plane to arrive, right? And because the plane yesterday for the same flight got canceled, so everybody, it was a full flight. If I went to Philadelphia Airport, I would have the same desire that I would just fly. I would get from point A to point B. Size didn't matter. Effectiveness does, is the point, right? And when you look at a church, you say, well, if we were a church of 10,000, we'd really be effective. No, no, no. It doesn't matter if you're a church of 10 or 10,000. If our heart, the heartbeat of our church, is not about worshiping Him, then we've missed it. And often, we get into this game of validating ourselves as a church by our size, by our structures, by our programs, by the things that we have. And we say, look at me! And God says, no, it's not about you. And we become critical because, well, you didn't do it quite right. It's not about you. You can't calm the sea. You can't heal the sick. You can't raise the dead. Only He can. Catch it? So, the next part is talking about our community. But if we don't have a healthy church, then reaching out to our community is only for selfish gain anyway. Right? But if it's out of a drive, out of a humble heart before God, where you say, God, you're much more valuable than my time, than my possessions, than everything that I have in my life, you're much more valuable, then over here becomes easy. As I close, I've got this one statement I wrote down. When we worship God, life rarely goes the way we planned. Keep that in mind this week. Because God may have some twists and turns in your life that you never thought of. And it might be the best thing ever for you and for the people around you. Let's pray. Lord, help us to worship you. Help us to value you above all of our things, all of our relationships, above everything. It's a struggle. We value validation. We value everything this life has to offer. We value the things that we have. We value all of that, and we struggle on a moment-by-moment basis, on a daily basis. So God, give us the courage to stand up to ourselves, to deny ourselves, to take up the cross and follow you. Even if, Lord, it means humiliation. Even if it goes totally against the plans that we had for us. Lord, guide us there, I pray. And Lord, we thank you. Thank you for all that you're doing. Thank you for the twists and turns that our life is going through. And Lord, help us to rest in you. Through Jesus, I pray. Amen.